Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast on VPX, VME, and Ready Technology. Today's speakers are from Curtiss-Wright Controls Embedded Computing, GE FANUC Intelligent Platforms, Hypercon, and Shroff. I'm Chris Schufo, Group Editorial Director at Open Systems Media. Of pertinence to today's eCast are our magazines, DSP-FPGA.com, VME and Critical Systems, and, of course, Military Embedded Systems. One of the benefits of VPX is lots of pins and possibilities, but it's also a drawback because there are almost too many choices. Toss in legacy VME boards and it gets even more interesting. Add in further options for slot pitch, cooling, and ESD control with Ready, and the choices for packaging get numerous as well. How do designers navigate the field of choices and get backplanes, system packaging, single board computers, and I/O modules to all work together? Today, listening to the experts in VPX and VPX Ready, we'll learn about the key elements of the standards, what's been learned from practical implementations, including using legacy VME boards with VPX boards in a system, what new initiatives like Open VPX mean, and what to consider when architecting VPX systems to make sure implementations go smoothly. First, some housekeeping items. Today's total briefing will consume about 50 minutes, leaving us 10 minutes or so for questions at the end. We have four presenters today. We have quite a few slides. On the audience console window before you, I encourage you to note a couple of buttons, the Enlarge Slides button and the Forward to a Friend button. With the latter, you can send an email to someone inviting them to participate live in this very eCast. As well, you'll also need to make sure you have all pop-up blockers disabled, or at least allow pop-ups from ON24. You'll also note on your console window a button that allows you to enter questions in real time. This is often the most interesting part of the eCast. We'll do our best to address all the questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question intended for a specific speaker, please so note at the beginning of your question. Else, I'll parcel the questions equally to our speakers. And if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, say your slides aren't moving, you're having audio trouble, one of our technicians will respond back to you privately during the eCast if you use the chat question. Note, as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. In fact, it's very likely. Our sponsors have also asked us to insert a short closing survey at the end of today's eCast. I do hope you'll take the 30 seconds or so required to check the boxes. And oh yes, before I forget, someone always asks, this eCast will be posted online within 48 hours. Let's begin. Our first speaker is Michael Slanowski from Curtiss-Wright Controls Embedded Computing. Mike is currently the product marketing manager for PowerPC single board computers in the Embedded Computing Group at Curtiss-Wright Controls. He has been with CWCEC for 7 years after spending 20 years in the telecom industry. Mike is a graduate of the University of Manitoba. Mike, you're up.
Yes, thank you very much, Chris. Good afternoon, everybody. What I'm going to spend the next 10 minutes on is just giving you a view of what Curtiss-Wright's view is of 3U VPX and how that applies to military applications. The first thing I'm going to address is what do we see from the slide as the slide goes forward there. There we go. What do we see from embedded computing trends? Multi-core embedded processors like x86 and PowerPC are becoming commonplace. Dual-core, multi-core processors are the word of choice, and everybody have those in their recent products. Processing speeds are going up. And so that means you can do more with the same processor that you used, or the same similar processor that you used about 2-3 years ago. MIPS per watt continues to improve, and so we're getting more MIPS with less power, and so that is allowing us to do many different things. Memory speeds continue to increase. DDR3 is becoming commonplace and will soon be a sweet spot, if not already, from a memory perspective. The amount of memory that our customers are demanding, too, is going up, which means they're doing more and more in the same processors that we used to use in the past. Integration is increasing. There's more and more system on chips. A good example is Freescale's recent P4080, 8 cores integrated with all the memory controllers and serial fabric controllers and acceleration engines has given us a lot more opportunity to do more in a much smaller space. And high-speed fabrics like PCI Express, Serial Rapid Aero are finding common place within our applications, and more our customers are demanding those as and moving away from the parallel fabrics like VME. We have many customers or many VME customers who actually don't use VME, and all they're using is really the form factor. Why? Because VME doesn't give them the speed and the performance that they require. And so what does this mean to the customer? Well, it's that SWOT equation, size, weight, and power. We can do what could be done in many SPCs in the past can generally be done with half to a quarter of what was available in the past. Weight-wise, by the fact that we're reducing the number of cards in the system, that means less weight, smaller form factors. As the MIPS per watt goes up, that means the power requirements go down. And so therefore, all that means is the fact that what we used to do in a large 6U system, we're seeing more and more customers doing in a smaller 3U system, be it VPX and or compact PCI. From a small form factor perspective, what we're seeing is historically 6U VME dominated the market. Even though there was a spec for a 3U VME system, no one ever really generated a card with that, and 6U was the commonplace. 3U compact PCI over the last 5 years has gained more and more acceptance and is addressing the smaller system requirements. But then compact PCI really hasn't been compatible with the modern high-speed fabrics that people are demanding. PCI Express, Serial Rapid Aero, good examples of those, allowing customers to do more with less. And so what we are seeing is that because of the fact that we can do a lot more computing and a lot less volume, we're seeing that smaller form factor becoming demanded in many, many more applications. There still is a demand and a place for 6U systems, but we're seeing 3U systems becoming more and more common and customers becoming more and more interested in that. Now, what does that mean from a VPX form factor perspective? As many are aware, the VITA ANSI standard for VPX 46 got approved 2 years ago. It's been designed into many current systems. And in reality, people are starting to use it where they really want to see those high-speed fabrics, both from an inter-card perspective, high-speed communications with other systems, as well as providing that higher performance. VPX, of course, is available in both 6U and 3U form factors, but we're seeing a lot of uptake within the 3U side, primarily because of that SWOT formula that we discussed a few slides back. Just to give people a quick view from a VPX mechanicals perspective, VPX, of course, still makes use of the existing standards. From a 3U perspective, the PygMy 2.0 Rev3 is air-cooled, is compliant. The Rev30.1, from a conduction-cooled perspective, is compliant. We basically provide mezzanines and XMCs or PMCICs on it. Backplane I/O is also supported. The one beauty, as Chris had mentioned, is the fact that you do have a lot more pins available for high-speed I/O. But the high-speed I/O, from a VPX perspective, is targeted for those high-speed applications, those applications in which customers are demanding that higher speed, both inter-card and out of systems. And VPX also provided the alignment blocks, keying blocks, robust mechanisms for, to avoid damage. It also has the VP ready perspective. VPX was designed from the word go for high speed. And so therefore the Tyco 2 connectors are designed in there just to provide those high speed interconnections. Again, for those high speed serial fabrics, high speed off board I/O. What are the advantages of 3U over compact PCI? Part of it is the fact that VPX, specifically from a 3U perspective, as well as 6U, was designed with high-speed and fabric-based interconnects from the word go. It was designed to provide that type of interconnect both between cards and out of the system. We also have more user-defined I.O. signals. Specifically in the 6U perspective, there's a lot more. 3U there is as well, but the format and the definition was more structured around that high-speed I.O. You know, VPX with the V248, the VPX ready, and the two-level maintenance. Again, cards have been designed with that to provide that flexibility for our customers both to do normal type of systems as well as those line replaceable modules in which the card is you know, field replaceable, which is something our customers are getting more and more interested in. As well as the recent release of the OpenVPX spec, now in essence provides a direction towards standard-based board and backplane profiles. And that allows our customers, therefore, to provide an easy way of interoperability because by the definition of slot profiles and backplane profiles, you know, cards from various different vendors can then be interused because of the fact that we've already defined that method for interconnecting them through a common profile. Just a few words on VPX or an OpenVPX. VPX specifications really focused on board level details, where OpenVPX, as I say in the slides, focuses on the system, on the issue of system specification. The slot profiles and the backplane profiles that are defined with an OpenVPX provide customers with the ability to create a set of standard boards that can then, in essence, be placed in the system defined by those slot profiles. You know, recently at Milcom, you know, Curtis Wright and Hypercon, you know, announced the first OpenVPX platform based on the OpenVPX principles, as you know, as well as you will hear this afternoon, many other of our competitors are also introducing those OpenVPX cards as well. And so that's going to become ubiquitous in the future and therefore, in essence, drive a whole new way that we can, in essence, create our systems. What does 3U provide us specifically is some, you know, the serial fabrics provide us with architectural flexibility. Moving to serial fabrics offers us many different type of architectural choices. You know, the distributed meshes that allow a full interconnect, centralized switching using a star tech topology, or even a centralized switching star topology that basically has redundancy built in. All those, in essence, provide our customers with much different flexibility than the traditional VME bus technology that we're all accustomed to. But do all applications benefit from high-speed serial fabrics? We basically have to ask that question because not everybody is going to definitely benefit from, you know, high-speed fabrics because not everybody needs them within their applications. People will basically ask, why 3U over 6U, right? You know, is there a benefit? Well, obviously 3U is physically smaller. It has a smaller footprint. But then, being small, it also limits I/O. So there are cases where 3U and 6U, the question becomes nebulous because once you get to four or five cards within a system, and I'm speaking of four or five 3U cards, you know the volume and the power and the space between a 3U and a 6U system is, you know, you're right on the verge of which way is better. Is it 3U or is it 6U? And that's a decision the system architect has to make is where is that drawing line of where when a 3U and a 6U system crosses. 3U systems can be sometimes easier to cool than a 6U system, partially because of the lower power density and airflow. But then again, it all depends on where you're going to slip this thing into. What's the application that it's going into? As I mentioned before, is 3U VPX there for all applications? No, not necessarily, right? 3U VPX does have fewer single pins than a 6U card. And so if the application really needs a lot of I/O, 3U might not be the solution. There are many 3U applications that use PCI Express, but again, there is some limited scalability. Serial Rapid I/O has been defined in OpenVPX as a data plane with next generation processors coming out with more Serial Rapid I/O links. Serial Rapid I/O interconnect may dominate a bit more from a high-speed processing perspective than PCI Express. But again, it really comes down to the real estate functions, the number of cards you're going to have within a system. 3U does provide smaller footprint for smaller systems, but it does have limits. And that's a decision that really comes from a system architect perspective of the application and the problem that he's trying to solve. But so what type of applications can benefit from 3U? Obviously, things like software-defined radios, which tend to be smaller platforms, ground vehicle sensing and processing within V-tronics, unmanned aerial vehicles. Obviously, those are applications where SWAT really is a concern, depending on the size of the UAV. And obviously, in the future, with the SWAP and what we're getting and seeing within our 3U. Possibilities, the door is open to new applications. And as integration of processors from all our vendors continues to shrink, it will, in essence, continue to provide more and more functionality. And it will be, therefore, up to the system architect to determine, hey, which direction do I go? So just to sum up, Curtiss-Wright does have a wide range of 3U VPX and OpenVPX products. We will see that coming from us as well as our other competitors providing more and more options within the 3U space. And so we will see 3U become more commonplace in the future, even more so than we've seen in the past, specifically as integration goes. Down, power goes down, and the applications go up. And so I see that I'm out of time, so I'm going to hand it back to Chris. Thank you for your time, and if you have any further questions, we'll be there to answer them at the end of the presentation. Over to you, Chris.
Thank you very much, Mike. Our second speaker today is Bob Sullivan from HyberCon. As Vice President of Technology at HyberCon, Bob is responsible for keeping abreast of industry technology trends, setting technical direction for the company, and defining technical approaches to solve challenging problems for the company's key customers. He is active in OpenVPX, VITA/VSO, and TICMIC technical standards committees. Bob is currently serving as chair of the VIA-68 VPX Compliance Channel Committee, secretary of the PICMIG Micro TCA.3 Hardened Conduction Cooled Micro TCA subcommittee, but doesn't say that on his business card, and he recently chaired the OpenVPX development chassis team and was an OpenVPX section editor. Bob has over 30 years' experience in the design of high-performance instrumentation and systems, holds a number of patents in the design of high-performance systems, and has authored numerous technical papers and magazine articles. Bob, over to you.
Thanks, Chris. So today I'm going to be talking about several issues related to packaging. First of all, module packaging options in VPX Ready. Next, I'll be talking about the chassis mechanical and cooling options that go along with those module packaging options. I'll talk about some backplane options, and in particular, OpenVPX, signal integrity performance, and then some conclusions. So as far as the modules go, there are several module cooling options out there. The two that you really see being deployed primarily are VITA48.1 air-cooled, which is used in development and selected harsh environments that are the less harsh variety for the air-cooled, and then VITA48.2 conduction-cooled, which is typically used in the most harsh environments. There are some new module cooling options that are not commonly used today. There are several flavors of the liquid flow through style, VDA 48.3, .4, and .6, and then the VDA 48.5 air flow through. And both of these, liquid in particular, but also air flow through, are suitable for very high power applications and harsh environments. VPX Ready also supports several different module pitches. Typically, 0.8, 0.85, and 1-inch pitch are supported, and VDA 48.5 supports up to a 1.52-inch pitch. Also, a key thing in VDA 48 or VPX Ready is that it optionally supports Type 1 module covers to provide two-level maintenance support, and that provides mechanical protection as well as ESD protection to allow these modules to be removed out in the field as opposed to having to return the entire chassis or assembly back to a depot level. So as far as chassis cooling options go, there's a lot of different ways to take the heat away from the product at a chassis level. The least effective is what we call natural convection, also called free air. And progressing through conduction to a forced air to a liquid style method. And there's a chart here at the right showing the relative goodness by the length of the bar on the right for different methods of cooling. A key thing in the applications that we're talking about here with VPX is that natural convection is really suitable for only for very, very low power applications and at low altitude as well, and it's not practical in most VPX applications. So looking at what do these chassis look like when you want to do an application, depending on what your power level is and what your other environmental constraints are, will determine what the best or optimum packaging solution is. Starting at the bottom here, we have conduction. You see a chassis over to the right. Blue chassis is a base plate cooled style conduction chassis. Moving up into forced air, can be done with conduction-cooled modules with air-cooled sidewalls, or it can be done with air-cooled modules that you cool directly with the external air, or you can have air-cooled modules with an air-to-air heat exchanger with a separate sealed internal compartment. And as you move into the hotter regimes, you'll see chassis over to the right representing liquid-cooled options at the higher power end of the scale, where you can have conduction-cooled modules with liquid-cooled sidewalls, or you could have air-cooled modules with a liquid-air heat exchanger and a sealed internal section. This slide here shows you what kind of application on the left might be mapped to a particular type of cooling approach on the right. The color of the arrows represents from red through purple to blue, relatively hotter for red and medium for purple and cooler for blue. And the dotted arrows represent limited shock and vibration type of applications where you're using air-cooled modules. So, for instance, if you're in a relatively controlled environment, ground mobile controlled, shipborne controlled, the ground sheltered, you can use forced air directly over the cards. You don't have a lot of issues of contaminants in the air or other environmental problems that would prevent you from using direct air. And when you get into an airborne uncontrolled type of scenario would be the most extreme environment where you typically wind up with liquid conduction for the highest power and then other forms of conduction cooled implementations depending on a particular platform and the power level. Okay. So the chassis mechanical and cooling options are very varied. There are a lot of options to choose from, and the best choice is really determined by the application, and that takes into account the platform environmental requirements, whatever constraints the platform has on cooling, like, for instance, does it have liquid available, platform constraints on the size and the weight, and the power dissipation. Those all come into play in determining what the best solution is. as far as the backplane goes, there's a new standard that's emerging called OpenVPX. It was just released from the OpenVPX group into the Vita 65 group at Milcom a couple of weeks back. And Vita 65 has just went out to ballot yesterday within Vita. So this is important moving forward because OpenVPX provides a framework for interoperability for VPX between multiple vendors with modules and backplanes, and provides a number of well-defined profiles supporting multiple planes for communication across the backplane. And this will allow systems to be tailored for different types of applications. You might have some multiprocessing-oriented applications that would have one type of profile, or you might have a control or a root leaf style application where you would have a completely different type of a profile. The OpenVPX profiles are used for development, and they're adapted for deployment as needed. And Hybricon, as well as a number of other competitors, will be offering backplanes and development chassis based on the new OpenVPX profiles. An important thing when it comes to VPX is signal integrity performance. One of the things that OpenVPX is doing is including higher speed fabrics supporting the 5 gig and 6.25 gig PCI Express Gen 2 and Serial Rapid I.O. Gen 2 speeds. I recently proposed, and I'm chairing, a new Vita 68 working group to establish a VPX compliance channel to address the current fabric speeds as well as the Gen 2 speeds, to make sure that when we have modules and backplanes that are compliant with the standards, when you put them together, they all work and play together. The OpenVPX specification does cite Vita 68 for signal integrity compliance, and we need to better define the signal integrity requirements to basically create, again, an interoperable platform that we can build on for the future. And the next couple of slides provide an example of Gen 1 Serial Rapid I.O. signal integrity challenges at 3.125 gigabits. And again, we're talking about going up to 6.25. At Hybricon, we simulated a 3.125 gigabit VPX Serial Rapid I.O. Channel using realistic module and backplane traces, 4-inch module traces and 12-inch backplane traces, using a relatively weak driver that does meet the Serial Rapid I.O. driver TX output spec, and used two different types of dielectric, an upgraded Nelco 4000-13 lower loss dielectric, as well as an FR4 dielectric, to see what happens, you know, with realistic components that can be used out there with different types of backplanes. And this eye diagram you see here is an FR4 backplane, again, only 12 inches long, but without any back drilling, and with a worst-case via stub on the connector press fit holes. And what you can see is that the eye diagram does not meet the minimum eye mask, and the internal red line here, which is the 10 to the minus 12 VER, is also violated. With an upgraded backplane material, as well as best-case back-drill via stubs, you can see that there's quite a bit of margin in the eye, both in terms of the eye mask and in terms of the BER. So you can see it does make a big difference how the backplane is actually designed, even at 3.125 gig speeds. So as a summary on signal integrity, even at 3.125 gig, with a weak Serial Rapid I.O. transceiver that's within spec and with realistic length traces, an FR4 backplane that is not back-drilled may not actually meet spec. And so those are the things that need to be nailed down and get make sure that all of the product that's out there that's compliant with Vita 68 and with OpenVPX will interoperate when you plug them together. So in conclusion, OpenVPX is the foundation that we need to go forward for VPX interoperability. It will accelerate adoption in the next generation of rugged applications. And there are many different types of packaging cooling options to choose from that are dependent on the application, what environmental requirements are, and what the power dissipation is. Key to this will be Vita 68 to enable interoperability as we transition to the Gen 2 speeds on the backplane. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bob. Next up today is RJ McLaren from Schroff. RJ is the systems product manager for Schroff, a division of Pentair, and has 9 years' experience in the electronic manufacturing industry. He has presented training materials and white papers in industry trade shows like the Advanced TCA and Micro TCA summits. RJ has worked previously as the communications segment manager for Schroff. Other roles include application engineer, program manager, and project engineering. He has a bachelor's degree in engineering and a master's in business administration from NNU. RJ, you now have our attention.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, Chris. So today I'm just going to focus mostly on some backplane topics related to VPX. I'm going to dive a little bit deep and highlight some of the features there. I'm going to start just doing a quick connector overview with some background, talk a little bit about VXS and hybrid examples, try to understand a little bit about why the need for the more high-speed, the fabric switching, and just kind of go into a little bit more of the connector details, talk about the utility plane within the backplane, discuss the flexible topology, and then end with a little bit of the OpenVPX that's been discussed, and also talk more about backplane modeling and testing and the importance there. Just to give a little bit of background, Pentair Schroff is a global company that offers a full line of electronic packaging and services for all markets. Pentair has an extensive indoor and outdoor cabinet portfolio and has a wide range of Vita and PGMA compliant system enclosures for bus structures such as VME Compact PCI and the XTCA architecture. We also specialize in mechanical components, the front panels, handles, sub-racks, and cases. We have the leading industry backplane design capability in manufacturing, as well as Pentair does have thermal solutions down from the wedge locks that is used in a lot of these clamshells and frames that are have been discussed, as well as manufacturing cooling frames up to air-cooled enclosures and systems through liquid cooling heat exchangers and also thermoelectric cooling products. So I just wanted to give a little bit of background based describing here the VME interconnect originated with a three-row DIN style connector. As new requirements come along, the 5-row DIN connector and the 2-millimeter hard metric connector was introduced with the features shown there. And these still maintain backwards compatibility to a standard VME line card. These type of improvements provide additional headroom to the VME system. And these types of connectors used have pins arranged such that the vertical and horizontal pitch positions of the contacts are symmetric, and this worked fine for the single-sided signals that were being used at the time. However, as been discussed here so far, the need for high-speed switching, there's a need for high-speed switching fabrics, and these types of differential signals operate better over pairs of pins that are closer to each other. These differential pairs should also be as far apart from each other and have the need for additional grounding. So this, as you know, of course everybody wants to have backwards compatibility in their next generation system, but this did force the need to break away from a backwards compatible type connector and move to a new style altogether, which is where the multi-gig connector was chosen and is being used. So this this new connector is a 7-row 16 wafer connector. The features that we get is within the VPX application allows for 32 high-speed differential pairs for the base fabric interface. There's allocation there for the 104 VME64 signals, 268 signals for user I/O, including an additional 128 high-speed differential pairs. So that provides for a total of 160 high-speed differential pairs possible. 28 signals for system utilities or spares, and then also the need for it to be a rugged connector, and that is obviously key for the application space this goes into. so to provide a little bit of background on migration, VXS, this connector was used in VXS Solutions. This backplane I'm showing here at the top left is a 6U 4-slot Vita 41 backplane example. You can see on the right, it's got a switch slot in position 4 and three node slots in positions 1, 2, and 3. And the high-speed multi-gig connector is used to provide traffic over the P0 position. So what's nice about this is you can use compatible VME64 extensions standard cards that could plug in there that you know would not have the P0 populated, and so this gives you, that backwards compatible option there. And the backplane shown next there is a 6U, an example of a 6U 7-slot VXS Hybrid backplane. And this one, there is no switch slot, and there's three slots that are connected with the P0 for the multi-gig, and those would have direct connections between those slots. And then also shown is just some the power supply slots for pluggable power supplies, and then just some standard VME64 extensions with the hard metric connector populated in the P0. If we look at some larger backplanes, those can be used for more of a redundant type solution. So the first backplane is a 12, showing up here is the 12 slot VXS backplane. In the center, it has 2X switch slots and then 10 payload slots. The second backplane is a larger system, a 20 slot VXS with again the two switch slots in the middle and then now up to 18 payload slots. So this allows for a dual SAR configuration that can support a redundant type system. The switch slots are located in the center. So this allows for the best location for optimized routing, including the lower layer count. So why do we need the higher bandwidth or more speed? And we've kind of heard that already, and we'll hear a little bit more from the folks that design the cards and can do integration. But the increasing use of graphics and video, data signaling processing, center data acquisition and processing, and more compute-intensive applications is basically what's driving the need for this requirement. The various protocols like PCI Express, InfiniBand, Serial Rapid I/O, and Ethernet are requiring these higher data rates for 3.25, 10, 40, and even eventually up to 100 gigabit per second there. As the military is upgrading and deploying for what's been much talked about, network-centric warfare, they are requiring these types of serial switch fabric interfaces for their systems, for the applications such as image and radar processing, signal processing, and digital radios, to name a few of those kind of applications. So again, this drive for the support to for these higher data rates drove the need for this new type of connector, as has been previously discussed. Within this connector, there are four types of wafers that are possible for configurations. These are single-ended, differential, even and odd wafers, and a power wafer. There are four different types of connector modules identified and shown here in the slide to build a VPX 6U slot, and then showing the three modules there for the 3U configuration. this slide here is shows a side view of a 3U backplane sketch with J0 through the J2 connector. Here I wanted to show the alignment keys that are an important feature within the VPX solution, so alignment key 1 and 2. The 3U solution provides up to 25 unique key settings. As we go to the 6U, there's an additional third key alignment that's added, and that can then provide up to 125 unique key settings. In general, it's only recommended. The feature's primarily there to prevent a board from being inserted into a slot that would have an incompatible high voltage input, and I'll go into that detail a little bit more here. The what's defined as the utility plane, or J0, uses an 8-wafer connector. This is loaded with 3 power wafers in positions 1, 2, and 3. The connector is also loaded with 3 of the single-ended 5-signal and 2 ground-style wafers in positions 4, 5, and 6. And these single-ended contacts are used for routine low-speed housekeeping functions like geographical address, systems management functions, reset, system reset, auxiliary power, and the non-volatile memory read-only. Also additional differential wafers are loaded in positions 7 and 8 for the JTAG signals and reserved feature bus feature use applications. The power is defined for 3U relating to the graph shown here for VS1 to be 12 volts, VS2 for 3.3 volts, and VS3 for 5 volts. When we move to 6U, VS3 is 5 volts, and then it can be optional power for 12 volts or 48 volts for the VS1 and VS2 definition, and thus the importance of understanding the keying options in regards to inserting your cards. So as a power example, if we consider VME card at 5 volts, it could be up to about 90 watts. If we look at VPX, you can have the 5 volts up to 15 watts, 12 volts at 384 watts, and then even 48 volts up to 768 watts. So definitely a different power range than before. So the advantage that's been discussed, and obviously the challenge really with VPX, is the flexibility in the topology. Other than the data plane, there's no mandate on the routing scheme. A mesh or star type topology is possible, and as shown, hybrids can be very interesting for systems integrators to continue to use legacy VME cards while taking advantage of the high-speed routing in only some of the slots. Here I'm showing an example of a 5-slot full mesh backplane shown here in the table with 32 differential pairs mapped on J1 with 4 differential pairs of 4 lanes each. Just kind of highlighted in the red frames showing the transmit and receive pins for the 4 ports A through D for each slot. And then just to kind of give you another look at that for a different understanding, different diagram, again showing the 5 slots and the routing of those ports. So slot 1 could be just a switch slot and connected to port A on each slot in the configuration. Then with additional port mapping to the other slots or between the other slots, then the full mesh topology is achieved. So part of the challenge with VPX, and again it's been discussed, has been the ability to provide standard-based solutions based on industry-accepted type routing schemes. So that has led to the forming of the group, the committee, the Open VPX.
RJ, excuse me a moment. This is Chris. I'm watching the clock, and we still have one more presenter. So if I could ask you to economize a couple of slides and then wrap it up, please.
Yeah. No, thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. And I'll just go quickly through some of the examples of Open VPX. different the slices and the slot counts. And actually, I can kind of go through this quickly since this was kind of reviewed previously from Bob. So the key thing that I'll talk a little bit more about and has been mentioned is the high-speed requirements and the need for testing and validation. And so there are techniques and a lot of experience that is required to create that channel mapping and the channel mode, the channel model generation. With that also requires backplane validation in regards to those design features. So just to wrap it up, from our side, VPX we feel is an exciting and highly flexible next generation platform for rugged applications. And with OpenVPX has been discussed here, we feel that we'll provide systems integrators and enclosure providers like ourselves to help fast-track these solutions to end users. So with that, Chris, I'll hand it back over to you.
Thanks very much, RJ. Our final speaker today is Herb Bethany from GE Fanuc Intelligent Platforms. Herb is also going to be joined today during the Q&A session by Jim Goldenberg, who's the chief engineer for GE Fanuc Embedded. Also watching the clock, I know that we've got a large queue of questions that have been coming in while these three presenters have been presenting. I'm sure there are going to be more during this final presentation. I'm going to ask our presenters to stay 10 minutes past the hour so we can get some of these questions answered. So we will have a hard stop at 10 minutes past the hour, but for those of you listening in, and there are quite a few of you, if you can adjust your schedules or if you care to adjust your schedules, we're going to go past 10 minutes. So Herb Bethany is Product Marketing Manager for GE Fanuc Mill and Aero Systems, Avionics, and Applied Image Processing Groups. Prior to his position at GE Fanuc, Herb held marketing roles at SBS Technologies. Before venturing into marketing, Herb was Director of Corporate Partners and a technical analyst and journalist at PC Week and eWeek News magazines, and a project leader at MITRE Corporation. He holds a BS from Suffolk University. Herb, you've got our final attention for the day.
Well, thank you, Chris, and hello, everyone. Hopefully, we still have an audience here. I'll just quickly go through some of the slides here. I don't want to take up too much of our time because I know we've got our Q&A, which tends to be the most interesting part. Just briefly to go over what and put in perspective what OpenVPX is, it's actually a part of the overall VPX spec, and it's to promote interoperability between the boards that VPX specifies, and it defines a set of system specifications to make sure that we have interoperability and integration between the various parts of a system. It's a follow-on to the VME and compact PCI. It doesn't necessarily supplant them, although over time probably the performance capabilities of VPX will come to the fore, and engineers and designers will design more VPX systems. It is highly scalable, highly flexible. It allows multiple planes and a backplane so that you can get that flexibility, and it does give us the two-level maintenance, which was referred to previously through VPX Ready, Vita 48, that lets us enable system maintenance in the field a lot easier. And, of course, vendors, integrators, and customers are truly looking forward to the VPX products and the follow-ons, and it does open up a lot of possibilities for new designs in avionics, multi-intelligence, radar, Vtronics, and so on. So it should give us a good group of products to work with. It does specify a set of system architectures, so it's not just a collection of pinout protocol specifications, as you might imagine with a typical board type spec. It allows system developers to choose a set of standard backplane module profiles, which have been defined, so that they can quickly get their system requirements up and running and get a system prototyped and in place. Certainly uses all the VPX or takes into consideration all the existing VPX standards of Vita 46, Vita 48, and all the DOT specs of Vita 46, like Vita 46.9, which specifies the modules, rapidly delivers results into the Vita standards organization. It was amazing to see how quickly the OpenVPX group was up and running and managed to get their specifications and standards submitted. And as was mentioned, the Vita 65 is out to the VSO members for balloting, and I imagine they'll get that done pretty quickly. It is a living document, so additional profiles for Vita 65 will be added over time as needed or as required by customer concerns and new applications that we've yet to see. Okay, here we go. As was stated, VPX is a very large, flexible specification, and flexibility is good in one way and sometimes not so good in another way. It's good for the customer to make sure that there's enough flexibility that their application needs are met. But because there are so many possible implementations, it could lead to interoperability issues between the boards, depending on how they respect still within the Vita specification. So essentially, OpenVPX was designed to address system architecture, and it has now moved into Vita 65, and it now gives us, within the VPX spec, a framework for interoperability between the different modules and backplanes that a system requires. And it is, of course, intended to be extensible so that it takes into account future considerations, future profiles, future products, future technology that will come down the pike, as we know, always does. Within that, it allows us and other vendors to have a broad product strategy so that we can take all the different pieces that we currently bring to market and integrate them for systems. If you have a particular part that you need, you can draw on Vita 65 specified products that allow you to plug them in so that you can put together a pretty good system that will allow you to satisfy all of a customer's needs depending on the type of application. Of course, the target applications are those applications that require a great deal of bandwidth and need pretty much high performance. And as mentioned, those are the manned and unmanned vehicles, mission computers, display processors, in particular, electronic warfare, of course, embedded training, all the other usual suspects that have been pushing the envelopes for so many years and are just, traditionally performance constrained. And hopefully Vita 65 or OpenVPX will let us get beyond that. Typical application, of course, radar. Generally, the smaller radar systems will benefit from, a 3U VPX solution. Of course, size, weight, and power are an issue. Typically, it's a Doppler radar, which would be the smaller based radar systems. 6U does have its advantages, especially 6U VPX. It does have a larger bit of real estate that allows you to put more on the board. However, it does, bring the size, weight, and power issue into consideration. But this is another case where VPX will lend itself to that, and that typical SAR-type radars would benefit from a 6U VPX approach. Of course, signal intelligence certainly could use it. You definitely need high-speed data paths from the tuner to your DSPs. Typically, you use serial rapid I/O. Serial fabrics, of course, are integral to VPX and OpenVPX, and they support the communications for quite a bit of high performance processing, multiple frequency searches, etc. The advantage, as was mentioned previously, to VPX and OpenVPX, it allows us to have separate planes so that we can have separate control plane. We could have separate data planes. We have power, utility, that sort of thing, which allows us to maximize the performance while maintaining pretty flexible control over the system in general. Another application, of course, is embedded training. One of the issues and some of the difficulties is to get embedded training in vehicle to allow as real training scenario as possible. And, of course, the space in a vehicle is constrained. However, you still need the high performance that realistic training will give you. And in that case, 3U VPX lends itself very well to that situation. It lets you have a pretty high-speed connection from the CPU to the GPU, and you can get pretty high fidelity for your simulations. And again, swap becomes a major issue when you're in those tight spaces in tanks and personnel carriers. A situational awareness is something that would give you, let's say, in a scenario on the battlefield, a 360-degree view of the battlefield and attempting to stitch together all those images that you would get, especially if you're using up to 16 cameras, requires an enormous amount of bandwidth and processing power. And if you can take that onto the backplane and pull in your camera data and then do your processing, you can pretty much implement that using 3U VPX. And in a particular scenario that we've put together, we've been able to implement an entire system using just 4 3U VPX cards. In summary, just to wrap it up, VPX and OpenVPX allows us to establish an ecosystem of solutions where we're pretty confident of having all the disparate pieces work together, from switches to I/O to the processors and graphic processors can all pretty much work and get a vendor up and running pretty quickly, and allow them to not only prototype, but then go to their final product in a pretty short amount of time. And that's the advantage that VPX and OpenVPX gives us. And in conclusion, I'm just going to turn this over to you, Chris, for the Q&A period.
Very good, Herb. Thank you very much. And I'd also like to have a special thank you to all of our presenters today. We are right at the top of the hour, and as I said before, Herb spoke. We're going to give an additional 10 minutes to 10 minutes after the hour for the Q&A session. We've got a number of questions here, so let's get right to them. All right, the first question is for Curtis Wright. How will multi-core processors and or virtualization be affected by VPX or OpenVPX?
Good question. How would virtualization be affected? I'm not sure there's really going to be an effect on that. There obviously will be, from the aspect that it will depend on how much each of the various products that are released, whether they actually support that virtualization within the OSs. Some will, some will not. Virtualization is taking a while to get into the marketplace. So I think in initially, you won't see a lot of that virtualization into the systems, but eventually as the products and the OSs start supporting them, you will see it in essence come into vogue. But I don't see that probably happening at least for a couple of years, specifically from what I can see within the marketplace.
Okay.
I open that to anybody else to answer it as well.
Anyone else care to comment on multi-core and virtualization and how those might affect VPX or OpenVPX? No takers. All right, very good. Moving on. Next question for Bob. I have the impression that a VPX backplane is customer specific. Am I right? Bob, are you there?
Sorry, I was muted.
No problem.
Yes and no. We're seeing both up to this point. We've seen more custom than standard, but that mix is going to tilt in the direction of standard with OpenVPX because of the defined profiles and more interoperability between different modules.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Next question for Shroff. I know if I buy 3 VME cards from 3 different vendors, they will likely play well together. First question, or first part of this long question, how many profiles have been approved? I assume they mean for OpenVPX. Number 2, how solid are these profiles? And number 3, should I expect the same interoperability with OpenVPX as VME, or will there still be guesswork involved? Complicated question. Let's take Shroff first on that.
Okay, thanks. Well, I think for clarification, I don't know. I think the from the OpenVPX perspective, that's been submitted. So perhaps for approved is not necessarily the correct word, but there have been within that specification, there are many different profiles in regards to 3 and 6U backplane routing suggestions on how to go about doing that. So within the large group, there's been a lot of good input, and so those are very good industry feedback into those profiles. So from a solid standpoint, I would say that they are very good recommendations in regards to how to go about doing that. So that's now going through that particular process within Vita. The from the interoperability standpoint with all the different flexibility, obviously care should be taken in reviewing what your integration is, what your chassis backplane is going to look like, and the cards you're going to use.
Okay, very good. Anyone else care to comment on this interoperability issue between VME and OpenVPX, and then between OpenVPX vendors? Maybe the board companies, Curtiss-Wright or GE Fanuc, folks care to comment?
Yeah, it's Mike. I tend to agree. I think initially you still will see a little bit of interoperability woes as we in essence get into the OpenVPX fold. But I think with the OpenVPX initiative and the maturing that we're seeing within the VPX community, as more and more cards get out there, there'll be more of an incentive to get that interoperability. And you'll see more of it coming, right? But I think, as things start maturing, it will, in essence, take a little bit of time, but I think you'll see it, specifically with some of the initiatives that we've seen coming out of the OpenVPX specification.
Okay, very good.
Now, this is Jim Goldenberg. I'd like to add to that OpenVPX or Vita 65 also has a requirement for compliance. So there are methodologies for ensuring that a board-level product meets the slot and backplane profile specifications to be called compliant. Now, the issue might arise when you're using boards that are compatible with, and that's where the system integrator or the end user needs to really look at data sheets probably more closely. But keep in mind that Vita 65 is not ratified yet, but as it is, as the board vendors reach compliancy, I believe the job of integrating will actually be easier than it has been with VME or Compact PCI in the past.
Okay, that's excellent. So let's play right off of that. Thank you very much, Jim, and pose this over to Bob. When will the Vita 65 standard be completed?
Well, as I think I mentioned or somebody else mentioned earlier, the OpenVPX or Vita 65 spec went out to a working group ballot within Vita yesterday. So we have to go through that ballot phase, and right now it's looking like this will go to ANSI ballot probably in the January timeframe. At least that's the schedule that Mark Littlefield, the chair of Vita 65, is talking about right now, and I don't see any obstacle in the way at this point.
Okay, very good. Next question is for GE. What are the power maximums for 3U VPX and 6U VPX? And feel free to specify whether that's convection or conduction cooling.
So within the open, Jim Goldenberg, within the open VPX discussions or meetings. We had lots of discussion around power requirements, and we kind of targeted that current and future designs 3U is usually at the top end around 75 watts per board, and on the on 6U 150 watts. Now, you've always got that 10 or 20% that fall outside of that, but from a development chassis specification, from a backplane routing requirement, we kind of targeted that level. So, for example, 3U 75 watts. Then you look at the number of slots in the backplane, and then you can determine the power supply requirements necessary to drive that level. Now, obviously, heat dissipation and other requirements of the system, other than just the how much power the board will handle, become important.
Certainly. Okay, thank you. Next question for Curtis Wright, and I am keeping my eye on the clock for you dear audience members following along with us. You said field replaceable, quote unquote. Please tell me what you think that means, and are you referring to two-level maintenance, and can you specify?
Yes, I'm referring to two-level maintenance. I think, as was mentioned by Bob in his presentation, it's the ability to replace cards in the field, that two-level maintenance, rather than shipping the whole chassis back, being able to change a card in the field. And Vita 48, with the covers and the specifications and the definition that we have from a Vita 46 perspective, being ESD compliant, et cetera, all those things allow that type of field replaceable unit to start being fielded. And we've seen interest in that in quite a few of our customers.
Okay, very good. I'm going to try to see if I can toss quick questions or economize on questions here by combining two of them together. I'm going to throw this one to Bob. Someone posed a question or talked about back drilling, and then there's another question here, Bob, that also talks about PWB stack-ups in terms of high-speed signals. So can you maybe address both of these things very quickly? What is back drilling, and do any of your signal integrity comments, are they affected by the stack-up of the PWBs?
Okay. Well, first of all, back drilling is removing a portion of the conductive barrel of the press fit hole. We think of it more on the backplane, but it can also be done on the module. And the reason that that's done is if the particular traces or trace connects to a layer that's near the top of the circuit board, then you can have a relatively long conductive barrel that could be 100 mils or 150 mils long, and what happens is that causes resonances. It becomes a stub that causes resonances and causes problems with signal integrity. So there's a technique called back drilling, so that if you have what's called, say, a top launch trace, that the particular hole associated with that trace would be then back drilled to remove part of that barrel to make the stub shorter. In terms of the stack up, certainly the stack up affects the impedance, and it depends on the dielectric, what the dielectric constant of the material is that's being used, whether it's FR4 or I mentioned NELCO 4000-13 is another one that we use. Also, the trace width affects the stack up, so if you need more layers, you need to go to a lower loss, lower dielectric constant material, or you need to go to thinner traces, which also increases the loss. So it's all an interactive part of the design that has to be taken into account.
Okay, very good. We're out of time. I'm going to answer the very last question that's posed here, although there are a number still in the queue. Someone posed the question, when will OpenVPX products be available? I can tell you that one. They're available today. We've seen a number of announcements from a number of manufacturers, including all of our four sponsors today, have announced OpenVPX products or imminent plans for OpenVPX products, so the market is open for those today. As I said, there are a number of questions here in the queue that we did not get a chance to answer. They're very good questions. I wish we had more time for them. They are all technical questions as well. But somebody will probably get back to you after the fact. Maybe four different companies may come back to you and answer your questions. So thank you for posing the questions. I'd like to thank our participants today. I'd especially like to thank our sponsors, Curtiss-Wright Controls Embedded Computing, GE FANUC Intelligent Platforms, Schroff, and HyberCon, although not necessarily in that order. The eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 48 hours. Thank you all for your indulgence. I'm sorry we're a little late, but I'm glad we did that. We're adjourned. Goodbye.